George's stateroom was panelled in teak. The walls hung with small but exquisite paintings by Rivers, Shan, de Kooning and Tanguy. A glass cabinet built into one wall held several rows of books. The floor was carpeted in wine red with a blue stylized octopus in the centre, its waving tentacles radiating out like a sunburst. The light fixture hanging from the ceiling was a lucite model of that formidable jellyfish, the Portuguese man of war. The bed was full size, with a rosewood headboard carved with Venetian seashell motifs. Its legs didn't touch the floor. The whole thing was supported on a huge rounded beam that allowed the bed to seesaw when the ship rolled, the sleeper remaining level. Beside the bed was a small desk. Going to it, George opened a drawer and found several different sizes of writing paper and half a dozen felt-tipped pens in various colours. He took out a Lille-size pad and a green pen, climbed on the bed, curled up at the head, and began writing.
April 24. Objectivity is presumably the opposite of schizophrenia, which means that it's nothing but acceptance of everybody else's notion of reality. But nobody's perception of reality is the same as everybody's notion of it, which means that the most objective person is the real schizophrenic. It's hard to get beyond the accepted beliefs of one's own age. The first man to think a new thought advances it very tentatively. New ideas have to be around a while before anyone will promote them hard. In their first form, they are like tiny, imperceptible mutations that may eventually lead to new species. That's why cultural cross-fertilization is so important. It increases the gene pool of the imagination. The Arabs, say, have one part of the puzzle, the Franks another. So, when the Knights Templar meet the Hashishim, something new is born. The human race has always lived more or less happily in the kingdom of the blind. But there is an elephant among us, a one-eyed elephant.
George put the pen down and read the green words with a frown. His thoughts still seemed to be coming from outside his own mind. What was that business about the Knights Templar? He had never felt the slightest interest in that period since his freshman year in college, when old Morrison Glynn had given him a D for that paper on the Crusades. It was supposed to be a simple research paper displaying one's grasp of proper footnote style, but George had chosen to denounce the Crusades as an early outbreak of Western racist imperialism. He'd even gone to the trouble of finding the text of a letter from Sinan, third leader of the Hashishim, in which he exonerates Richard Coeur de Lion of any complicity in the murder of Conrad of Montferrat, King of Jerusalem. George felt the episode demonstrated the essential goodwill of the Arabs. How was he to know that Morrison Glynn was a staunch conservative Catholic? Glynn claimed, among other dyspeptic criticisms, that the letter from the castle, called Messiah, was well known as a forgery. Why were the Hashishim coming back to mind again? Did it have to do with the weird dream he'd had of the temple in the Mad Dog jail? The sub's engine was vibrating pleasantly through the floor, the beam, the bed. The trip so far had reminded George of his first flight in a 747. A surge of power followed by motion so smooth it was impossible to tell how fast or how far they were going. There was a knock at the stateroom door, and at George's invitation, Hagbard's receptionist came in. She was wearing a tight-fitting golden-yellow slack ensemble. She stared compellingly at George, her pupils huge obsidian pools, and smiled faintly.
"Will you eat me if I can't guess the riddle?"
George said.
"You remind me of a sphinx."
Her lips, the colour of ripe grapes, parted in a grin.
"I modelled for it. But no riddle. Just an ordinary question. Hagbard wants to know if you need anything. Anything but me. I've got work to do now."
George shrugged.
"You beat me to the question. I'd like to get together with Hagbard and find out more about him and the submarine and where we're going. We're going to Atlantis. He must have told you that.
She shifted her weight from one foot to the other, rolling her hips. She had marvelously long legs.
Atlantis is, roughly speaking, about halfway between Cuba and the west coast of Africa at the bottom of the ocean. Yeah, well, that's where it's supposed to be, right? Right. Hagbard's going to want you in the captain's control room later. Meanwhile, smoke some of this if you want. Helps to pass the time.
She held out a gold cigarette case. George took it from her, his fingers brushing the velvety black skin of her hand. A pang of desire for her swept through him. He fumbled with the catch of the case and opened it. There were slender white tubes inside, each one stamped with a gold K. He took one out and held it to his nose. A pleasant, earthy smell.
"We've got a plantation and a factory in Brazil,"
she said.
"Hagbard must be a wealthy man." "Oh, yeah. He's worth billions and billions of tons of flax." "Well, look, George, if you need anything, just press the ivory button on your desk. Someone will come along. We'll be calling you later."
She turned with a languid wave and walked down the fluorescent-lit corridor. George's gaze clung to her unbelievable ass till she climbed a narrow flight of carpeted stairs and was out of sight. What was that woman's name? He lay down on the bed, took out a joint and lit it. It was marvellous. He was up in seconds, not the usual gradual balloon ascent, but a rocket trip, not unlike the effect of amyl nitrate. He might have known this Hagbard Chalene would have something special in the way of grass. He studied the sparkles glinting through the Portuguese man-of-war and wiggled his eyeballs rapidly to make the lights dance. All things that are lights. The thought came that Hagbard might be evil. Hagbard was like some robber baron out of the 19th century. Also like some robber baron out of the 11th century. The Normans took Sicily in the 9th century, which gave you mixtures of Viking and Sicilian. But did they ever look like Anthony Quinn? Or his son, Greg Lastrada? What son? What the son done cannot be undone, but is well done. The quintessence of evil. Nemesis of all evil. God bless us, every one. Even one. Odd, the big red one. I think it was his eye. The eye of Apollo. His luminous eye, Aum Shiva.
Aye, trust me not. Trust not a man who's rich in flax. His morals may be sadly lax. Her name is Stella. Stella Maris. Black Star of the Sea.
The joint was down to the last half inch. He put it down and crushed it out. With grass flowing like tobacco around here, it was a luxury he could afford. He wasn't going to light another one. That wasn't a high. That was a trip, a Saturn rocket, right out of the world and back just as fast.
George, I want you in the captain's control room.
Clearly, this hallucinating of voices and images meant he wasn't all the way back. Re-entry was not completed. He now saw a vision of the layout of that part of the submarine between his stateroom and the captain's control room. He stood up, stretched, shook his head, his hair swirling around his shoulders. He walked to the door, slid it back, and walked on down the hall. A little later, he stepped through a door onto a balcony, which was a reproduction of the prow of a Viking ship. Above, below, in front, to the sides, was green-blue ocean. They seemed to be in a glass globe projecting into the ocean. A long-necked red and green dragon with golden eyes and a spiky crest reared above George and Hagbard.
My approach is fanciful rather than functional,
Hagbard said.
If I weren't so intelligent, it would get me into a lot of trouble.
He patted the dragon figurehead with a black furred hand. Some Viking, George thought. A Neanderthal Viking, perhaps.
That was a good trick,
George said, feeling shrewd but still high.
How you got me up on the bridge with that telepathy thing?
I called you on the intercom,
Hagbard said with a look of absurd innocence.
You think I can't tell a voice in my head from a voice in my ears?
Hagbard roared with laughter, so loud that it made George feel a little uncertain.
Not when you've had your first taste of Callisti gold, man.
Who am I to call a man a liar when he's just turned me on with the best shit I've ever had?
Said George with a shrug.
I suspect you of making use of telepathy. Most people who have that power would not only not try to hide it, they'd go on television.
Instead, I put the ocean on television,
said Hagbard. He gestured at the globe surrounding their Viking prow.
What you see is simply color television with a few adaptations and modifications. We are inside the screen. The cameras are all over the surface of the sub. The cameras don't use ordinary light, of course. If they did, you wouldn't be able to see anything. The submarine illuminates the sea around us with an infrared laser radar, to which our TV cameras are sensitive. The radiations are of a type that is more readily conducted by the hydrogen in the water than by any other element. The result is that we can see the ocean bottom almost as clearly as if it were dry land and we were in a plane flying above it.
That'll make it easy to see Atlantis when we get to it,
George said.
By the way, why did you say we're going to Atlantis again? I didn't believe it when you told me, and now I'm too stoned to remember.
The Illuminati are planning to loot one of the greatest works of art in the history of man, the Temple of Tethys. It happens to be a solid gold temple, and their intention is to melt it down and sell the gold to finance a series of assassinations in the U.S. I intend to get there before them.
The reference to assassinations reminded George that he'd gone down to Mad Dog, Texas, on Joe Malik's hunch that he'd find a clue there to an assassination conspiracy. If Joe knew that the clue was leading 20,000 leagues under the sea and eons back through time, would he believe it? George doubted it. Malik was one of those hard-nosed scientific leftists. They had been acting and talking a little strangely lately.
Who did you say was looting this temple?
He asked Hagbard.
The Illuminati. The real force behind all communist and fascist movements. Whether you're aware of it or not, they're also already in control of the United States government.
I thought everybody in your crowd was a right-winger.
And I told you, spatial metaphors are inadequate in discussing politics today.
Hagbard interrupted.
Well, you sound like a gang of right-wingers. Up until the last minute, all I've heard from you and your people was that the Illuminati were commies, or were behind the commies. Now you say they're behind fascism and behind the current government in Washington, too.
Hagbard laughed.
We came on like right-wing paranoids at first to see how you'd react. It was a test.
And?
You passed. You didn't believe us. That was obvious. But you kept your ears and your eyes open and were willing to listen. If you were a right-winger, we would have done our pro-communist rap. The idea is to find out if a new man or woman will listen, really listen, or just shut their minds at the first really shocking idea.
I'm listening, but not uncritically. For instance, if the Illuminati control America already, what's the purpose of the assassinations?
Their grip on Washington is still pretty precarious. They've been able to socialize the economy. But if they showed their hand now and went totalitarian all the way, there would be a revolution. Middle readers would rise up with right-wingers and left-libertarians, and the Illuminati aren't powerful enough to withstand that kind of massive revolution. But they can rule by fraud. And by fraud, eventually acquire access to the tools they need to finish the job of killing off the Constitution.
What sort of tools?
More stringent security measures, universal electronic surveillance, no-knock laws, stop-and-frisk laws, government inspection of all first-class mail, automatic fingerprinting, photographing, blood tests, and urinalysis of any person arrested before he's charged with a crime. A law making it unlawful to resist even unlawful arrest. Laws establishing detention camps for potential subversives, gun control laws, restrictions on travel. The assassinations, you see, establish the need for such laws in the public mind. Instead of realizing that there is a conspiracy conducted by a handful of men, the people reason, or are manipulated into reasoning, that the entire populace must have its freedom restricted in order to protect the leaders. The people agree that they themselves can't be trusted. Targets for assassinations will be mavericks of left or right who are either not part of the Illuminati conspiracy or have been marked as unreliable. The Kennedy brothers and Martin Luther King, for example, were capable of mobilizing a somewhat libertarian left-right black-white populist movement. But the assassinations that have occurred so far are nothing to what will take place. The next wave will be carried out by the Mafia, who will be paid in Illuminati gold.
Not Moscow gold?
Said George with a smile.
The puppets in the Kremlin have no idea that they and the puppets in the White House are working for the same people. The Illuminati control all sorts of organizations and national governments without any of them being aware that others are also controlled. Each group thinks it's competing with the others, while actually each is playing its part in the Illuminati plan. Even the Morituri, the six-person affinity groups which splintered from the SDS Weathermen because the Weathermen seemed too cautious, are under the control of the Illuminati. They think they're working to bring down the government, but actually they are strengthening its hand. The Black Panthers are also infiltrated. Everything is infiltrated. At present rate, within the next few years, the Illuminati will have the American people under tighter surveillance than Hitler had the Germans. And the beauty of it is, the majority of the Americans will have been so frightened by Illuminati-backed terrorist incidents that they will beg to be controlled as a masochist begs for the whip.
George shrugged. Hagbard sounded like a typical paranoid. But there was this submarine and the strange events of the past few days.
So the Illuminati are conspiring to tyrannize the world, is that it? Do you trace them back to the First International?
No. They're what happened when the Enlightenment of the 18th century collided with German mysticism. The correct name for the organization is Ancient Illuminated Seers of Bavaria. According to their own traditions, they were founded or revived in 1776 on May 1st by a man named Adam Weishaupt. Weishaupt was an Unfrocked Jesuit and a Mason. He taught that religious and national governments had to be overthrown and the world ruled by an elite of scientifically minded materialistic atheists to be held in trust for the masses of mankind who would eventually rule themselves when enlightenment became universal. But this was only Weishaupt's outer doctrine. There was also an inner doctrine, which was that power is an end in itself, and that Weishaupt and his closest followers would make use of the new knowledge being developed by scientists and engineers to seize control of the world. Back in 1776, things were run largely by the church and the feudal nobility, with the capitalists slowly getting a bigger and bigger piece of the pie. Weishaupt declared that these groups were obsolete, and it was time for an elite with a monopoly on scientific and technological knowledge to seize power. Instead of producing a democratic society, as the outer doctrine promised, the ancient illuminated seers of Bavaria would saddle mankind with a dictatorship that would last forever.
Well, it would be logical enough that someone around that time would think of that,
said George.
And who more likely than a Mason who was an unfrocked Jesuit?
You recognize that what I tell you is relatively plausible,
said Hagbard.
That's a good sign.
A sign that it's plausible?
Laughed George.
No. A sign that you're the kind of person I'm always looking for. Well, the Illuminati, after staying above ground long enough to recruit a hardcore membership from Masons and Freethinkers and to establish international contacts, allowed it to seem that the Bavarian government had suppressed them. Subsequently, the Illuminati launched their first experimental revolution in France. Here, they suckered the middle class, whose true interests lay in laissez-faire free enterprise, to follow the Weishaupt slogan of liberty, equality, fraternity. The catch, of course, is that where equality and fraternity rule, there is no liberty. After the career of Napoleon, whose rise and fall was purely the result of Illuminati manipulations, they started planting the seeds of European socialism, leading to the revolutions of 1848, to Marxism, finally to the seizure of Russia, one-sixth of the Earth's landmass. Of course, they had to engineer a world war to make the Russian Revolution possible, but by 1917 they become quite good at that. World War II was an even more clever job, and resulted in more gains for them. Another thing this explains,
George said,
is why Orthodox Marxism-Leninism, in spite of all its ideals, always turned out to be not worth a shit. Why it's always betrayed the people wherever it established itself. And it explains why there's such an inevitable quality about America's drift toward totalitarianism.
Right, said Hagbard.
America is the target now. They've got most of Europe and Asia. Once they get America, they can come out into the open. The world will then be much as Orwell predicted in 1984. They bumped him off after it was published, you know. The book hit a little too close to home. He was obviously onto them. The references to inner and outer parties with different teachings, O'Brien's speech about power being an end in itself. And they got him. Orwell, you see, ran across them in Spain, where they were functioning quite openly at one point during the Civil War. But artists also arrive at the truth through their imaginations, if they let themselves wander freely. They're more likely to arrive at the truth, the more scientific-minded people.
You've just tied 200 years of world history up in a theory that would make me feel I should have myself committed if I accepted it,
said George.
But I'm drawn to it, I admit. Partly intuitively, I feel you're a person who's essentially sane, not paranoid. Partly because the orthodox version of history that I was taught in school never made sense to me. And I know how people can twist history to suit their beliefs, and therefore I assume that the history I've learned is twisted. Partly because of the very wildness of the idea. If I learn one thing in the last few years, it's that the crazier an idea is, the more likely it is to be true. Still and all, given all those reasons for believing you, I would like some further sign.
Hagbard nodded.
All right, a sign. So be it. First, a question for you. Assuming your boss, Joe Malik, was onto something, assuming that the place he sent you to did have something to do with assassinations and might lead to the Illuminati, what would be likely to happen to Joe Malik?
I know what you're suggesting. I don't like to think about it.
Don't think.
Hagbard suddenly pulled a telephone from under the railing of the ship.
We can tap into the Bell system through the Atlantic cable from here. Dial the New York area code and dial any person in New York, any person who could give you up-to-date information on Joe Malik and on Confrontation Magazine. Don't tell me who you're dialing. Otherwise you might suspect I had someone on the ship impersonate the person you want to speak to.
Holding the phone so Hagbard couldn't see, George dialed a number. After a wait of about 30 seconds, after numerous clicks and other strange sounds, George could hear a phone ringing. After a moment, a voice said,
"Hello. This is George Dorn,"
said George.
"Who's this?" "Well, who the hell do you think it was? You dialed my number."
"Oh, Christ,"
said George.
"Look, I'm in a place where I don't trust the phones. I have to be sure I'm really talking to you. So I want you to identify yourself without my telling you who you're supposed to be. Do you understand?"
"Of course I understand. You don't have to use that grade school language. This is Peter Jackson, George, as I presume you intended that it should be. Where the hell are you? Are you still in Mad Dog?"
"I'm at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean."
"Knowing your bad habits, I'm not surprised. Have you heard about what happened to us?" Is that why you're calling? No. What happened?
George gripped the telephone tighter.
The office was blown up by a bomb early this morning, and Joe has disappeared.
Was Joe killed?
Not as far as we know. There weren't any bodies in the wreckage. How about you? Are you okay?
I'm getting into an unbelievable story, Peter. It's so unbelievable that I'm not going to try to tell you about it, not till I get back. If you're still running a magazine there, then...
As of now, there's still a magazine, and I'm running it from my apartment.
St. Peter.
I only hope they don't decide to blow me up.
Who?
Whoever. You're still on assignment. And if this has anything to do with what you've been doing down in Mad Dog, Texas, you're in trouble. Reporters are not supposed to go around getting their boss's magazines bombed.
You sound pretty cheerful, considering Joe might be dead.
Joe is indestructible. By the way, George, who's paying for this call?
A wealthy friend, I think. He's got a corner on Flax or something like that. More on him later. I'm going to sign off now, Pete. Thanks for talking.
Sure. Take care, baby.
George handed the phone to Hagbard.
Do you know what's happened to Joe? Do you know who bombed Confrontation? You knew about this before I called. Your people are pretty handy with explosives.
Hagbard shook his head.
All I know is the pot is coming to a boil. Your editor, Joe Malik, was on to the Illuminati. That's why he sent you to Mad Dog. As soon as you show your face down there, you get busted and Malik's office is bombed. What do you think?
I think that what you've been telling me is the truth, or a version of it. I don't know whether to trust you completely, but I've got my sign. If the Bavarian Illuminati don't exist, something does. So then, where do we go from here?
Hagbard smiled.
Spoken like a true homo neophilus, George. Welcome to the tribe. We want to recruit you because you're so gullible. That is, gullible in the right way. You're skeptical about conventional wisdom, but attracted to unorthodox ideas. An unfailing mark of a homo neophilus. The human race is not divided into the irrational and the rational, as some idealists think. All humans are irrational. But there are two different kinds of irrationality. Those who love old ideas and hate and fear new ones, and those who despise old ideas and joyfully embrace new ones. Homo neophobus and homo neophilus. Neophobus is the original human stock, the stock that hardly changed at all for the first 4 million years of human history. Neophilus is the creative mutation that has been popping up at regular intervals during the past 1 million years, giving the race little forward pushes, the kind you give a wheel to make it spin faster and faster. Neophilus makes a lot of mistakes, but he or she moves. They live life the way it should be lived, 99% mistakes and 1% viable mutations. Everyone in my organization is Neophilus, George. That's why we're so far ahead of the rest of the human race. Concentrated neophilus influences without any neophobe dilution. We make 1 million mistakes, but we move so fast that none of them catch up with us. Before you get any deeper, George, I'd like you to become one of us.
Which means what?
Become a legionnaire in the Legion of Dynamic Discord.
George laughed.
Oh, that sounds like a gas. But it's hard to believe that an organization with an absurd name like that could build anything as serious as this submarine or work for such a serious end as foiling the ancient illuminated seers of Bavaria.
Hagbard shook his head.
What's serious about a yellow submarine? It's right out of a rock song. And everybody knows people who worry about the Bavarian Illuminati are crackpots. Will you join the Legion? In whatever spirit you choose.
Certainly,
said George promptly. Hagbard clapped him on the back.
Ah, you're our type, all right. Good. Back through the door you came then, turn right, and through the golden door.
Is there someone lifting a lamp beside it?
There are no honest men on this voyage. Get along with you now.
Hagbard's full lips curled in a leer.
You're in for a treat.
Every perversion.
Smiling Jim screamed.
Men having sex with men. Women having sex with women. Obscene desecrations of religious articles for deviant purposes. Even men and women having sex with animals. Why, friends, the only thing they haven't got around to yet is people copulating with fruits and vegetables, and I guess that'll be next. Some degenerate getting his kicks with an apple.
The audience laughed at the wit.
You've gotta run very fast to catch up with the sun. That's the way it is when you're lost out here,
the old woman said, stressing the last five words in a kind of childish sing-song. The woods were incredibly thick and dark, but Barney Muldoon stumbled after her.
It's getting darker and darker,
she said darkly.
But always dark when you're lost out here.
Why do we have to catch the sun? Barney asked, perplexed.
In search of more light,
she cackled gleefully.
You always need more light when you're lost out here.